Hello, and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff. The Powerful Patient is a program dedicated to the interests of people with complex medical conditions and disabilities. We help you learn how to manage your health and how to manage your healthcare team. Today we have with us a very interesting guest. He is a nurse practitioner, and a PhD in nursing. He specializes in quality of patient care and how to improve patient care in hospitals. So we're going to talk today with Dr. Sean Clark of the University of Toronto. He's been at the University of Pennsylvania for the last 10 years and has just moved now to the University of Toronto, where he is going to be teaching how to improve patient care. So let's talk today with Dr. Clark. We'll be back in just a minute after this message, and please stay with us for a very interesting hour ahead. The Powerful Patient is brought to you as a public service by the VHL Family Alliance. Read about us at our website at powerfulpatient.org. There's also a handout that goes with this show, which we hope you'll go and pick up. So go to powerfulpatient.org and look there for the handout. That's powerfulpatient.org. Welcome back. This is Joyce Graff, and we're going to be speaking today with Dr. Sean Clark. Welcome, Dr. Clark.
So tell me about your new position.
I was just appointed to an endowed chair from the Royal Bank of Canada Financial Group. They co-funded it with the University of Toronto. It's a chair in cardiovascular nursing research, and it involves me spending about half my time at the hospital doing research with nurses and doctors to try and improve the quality of cardiac care, and about the other half of the time teaching at the Lawrence S. Bloomberg Faculty of Nursing, and I teach health policy and professional issues as well as things around the quality and safety of healthcare.
So you've been working with quality of healthcare for quite some time, right?
About 10 years, actually.
Mm-hmm. And so what have you found in that 10-year period? Why are there so many problems with the quality of care, and what can we do about it?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's kind of interesting, I came into patient safety and quality of care in 1999, around that time. In 1999, there was a huge report that had a massive impact on people internationally in terms of thinking about quality of care, called To Err Is Human. And it was not necessarily new research, but sort of a restatement of some research that had been done perhaps 10 years ago, suggesting that medical errors were really common, that quality of care was fairly inconsistent, and not necessarily what we would hope for. And it was sort of a signal, a call to health professionals to take a second, very hard look at what we were doing in healthcare. So I think in the time that I've been in the field, we've seen a lot of interest. People have always been interested in delivering high-quality healthcare, but I think it was sort of bracketed and in the background. It was a topic that people didn't want to really discuss. Now I think it's sort of out in the open and front and center. Unfortunately, I think sometimes what happens is that we might be, it's not that we might be telling families and patients too much about what goes on in terms of quality and safety, but I guess sometimes the news stories that are based on the research that we do emphasize things that are rather frightening, I guess, especially to somebody from the outside, especially somebody receiving healthcare services. So to get directly to your question, what have we learned? I think as time goes on, we learn more and more that whether healthcare is safe or whether it's not, whether it's of really good quality, in that basically it brings up-to-date research, things are done well, things care is coordinated with the patient's family, it respects the patient's wishes, all of those things, all of those different aspects of quality and safety and care Come down, yes, to what individual doctors and nurses and other health professionals are doing, but is very much a product of how good the team functioning is, which I guess is something that we've always known, but we're sort of getting more and more evidence for that in terms of showing what happens or what's more likely to happen when teamwork isn't good or when staffing isn't good or whatever.
There's some pretty mind-blowing statistics out there, and as you point out, we really don't know what it was before. You know, do we know what the statistics were 10 years ago? But right now they're saying that like 100,000 people a year die in hospitals because of medical mistakes.
Yes, and that every day that the average patient spends in the hospital, he or she experiences at least one medication error, which is pretty dramatic, too. These are not encouraging numbers. And it's interesting because when the research is done in other countries, the 100,000 deaths a year estimate comes from American research that was done in the early 1990s. A replication of that study was done by some people who are now my colleagues here in Toronto. And basically, the numbers are on exactly the same scale in Canada when you look closely at this. I think we've always wanted to have confidence that everything was all right. And when you don't actually study and bring hard numbers to some of this stuff, you don't realize just how large the problem might be.
Yeah. No. Obviously, we want our healthcare treatment to be perfect, and somehow we expect our doctors and nurses to be perfect. But as you point out, doctors and nurses are human beings, and they sometimes have good days and sometimes have bad days, and they aren't perfect. So how do we somehow drive more perfection into an inherently imperfect system?
Right. I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head when you say that health professionals are human, and they will make mistakes. Of course, we have to train people properly, and we have to make sure that we keep their knowledge up to date, and we have to help them learn from mistakes that others have made, not only in their own clinics and hospitals and so forth, but put the word out about mistakes, honest mistakes, but serious mistakes that happen. In around the world. I think that's really important.
You don't learn from mistakes that are buried.
Exactly. And so transparency is a really important thing, a willingness to come forward, sort of generating that in people, and also making sure that the reactions that people get, the responses from their managers and so forth, are as non-punitive as possible. Now, that's easy enough
so
to
if,
say.
If you fess up to a mistake and they come down on you with all 4 feet and fire you or something, obviously you didn't learn anything from that mistake except to hide the next one.
Absolutely. But and absolutely in the U.S. context, I mean, it's particularly the whole notion of medical malpractice, the whole crisis, some people call it, that we're facing with respect to people suing. At one time, it was widely thought that any sort of admission of error was a near guarantee that you or your institution or perhaps both would get sued potentially to the tune of very, very large, large settlements.
Yeah, 7 figures somewhere.
Yeah, depending on just how severe the error was. But what we've learned is that a lot of lawsuits are actually triggered by patients and families feeling as if they're not being dealt fairly with, that they can't get the real facts of what went on. And it's an interesting thing that what the research seems to suggest is that a lot of errors are made that patients are fully aware of, and the patients and the families don't sue. And that is probably a function of, in a lot of cases, what patients and families are not necessarily expecting absolute perfection, but they are expecting honesty. They are expecting honesty and a caring attitude. And that means some very definite things about the way we think about error and we talk about error with patients and families, especially for patients who face sort of long courses of treatment with multiple health professionals in the system. They'll often it's almost inevitable. Sort of the more if even in 1% of every single contact with a health professional, you have a problem, an error that happens. Well, multiply that out by, you know, literally the hundreds, if not thousands, of contacts that you have if you're a long-term patient of some kind in the healthcare system, and things will happen. Again, patients, you know, when it comes down to it, nobody wants to be subjected to errors. Nobody wants to be a guinea pig. But at the same time, patients and families are remarkably understanding. And if we pay attention to the human side of what it is to deal with that human capacity for error, both on the health professional side and the patient side, we'll all be better off, I think.
Yes, you know, one of the things I tend to liken this to is the changeover we've gone through in childbirth in this country. I had a baby in 1971 when natural childbirth was brand new, and at that point the doctors were saying, oh, knock her out, please. I don't need her interfering with my work, you know, and father's in the delivery room. Are you kidding? He'll pass out. So that was the attitude. Now they're realizing that an educated parent is actually much more cooperative and helpful, and they don't sue you. They understand that this is not a perfect system, that things can go wrong, that there may be a time that you'll be asked to leave so that the doctor can get down and do exactly what's necessary, and that's the educated patient is the one who doesn't sue, and it really can be helpful. So I think that, as you say, the communication with the family is extremely important.
Absolutely, and the communication with between the different members of the team as well. And and if the patient is informed and engaged, the patient, while I would never want to imply that I believe that we should make patients responsible for for preventing medical errors, it is remarkable the number of cases that come up of prevented errors, for instance, that are prevented expressly because someone took the time to listen to a patient saying, that's not the medication that I was prescribed, or actually it was the left leg, not the right leg,
right,
and so forth, which is sort of a signal. Again, we should have systems that where there's good communication, accurate reporting, recording, and so forth. We should be trying to weed out as much of the human error as possible, but patients and families are absolutely one of the main lines of defense in keeping errors to a minimum.
Right, and telling the patient and the family what kinds of things to watch out for, I think, is also important. One of the experiences I had when my son was 15 and was in the hospital, he had an IV in, and they had taken him downstairs to get an X-ray. They brought him back up, and, of course, he was jostled in and out of the bed and everything, and they got him all settled, and the nurse went on about her business. And I'm standing there with my son, and I look over at the IV tube, and I see about a 3-inch bubble making its way down the IV tube. And I said, I reached over, I folded the IV tube in half and rang the nurse buzzer.
Right.
And she came in and I said, would you please fix this? And she looked at it and just sort of busily fixed it. And then after it was fixed, she said to me, oh, he's young and strong. He probably would have been okay. And I'm going, probably. I don't want to hear probably. This is my one and only son.
Yeah, and unfortunately, one of the things that's been happening, you know, even though I think we made a lot of progress in the past 10 years in terms of patient safety and consciousness of a lot of the quality issues, one of the things that we haven't really worked out is how we maintain a degree of humanity in hospital settings that are getting busier and busier and busier. I mean, that response back from the nurse, I mean, was surely meant to be a comfort to you,
right,
but really was also meant to sort of, you know, move aside your particular concern so that she could move on with her day.
Right.
And I think a lot of patients these days in hospitals, perhaps not so much the ones who have good results, I guess, from whatever treatment they receive, but patients who run into problems, they especially feel jostled around and not really listened to, I guess. And that's not good. That's not good at all.
One of the things I hear from patients quite often is when a mistake is made, the hospital closes ranks, won't speak to them, the doctor won't answer their calls, and the frustration builds and builds until they call a lawyer.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think these days there are many corners of the healthcare industry, from professional associations to the Joint Commission that accredits hospitals and other healthcare agencies and so forth. A lot of people have recognized that that silence and that shutting down make situations much, much worse than they need to be, and that it's psychologically damaging for patients and, you know, obviously provokes lawsuits. But more importantly, it sort of permanently changes the way patients think of the healthcare professionals that are supposed to be helping them. It puts them, it erodes trust.
Yeah, and it becomes an adversarial.
Absolutely. And for the professionals itself, we don't talk so much about this, but for the professionals themselves, it becomes a very damaging thing as well, because they start thinking of patients who don't respond as they should, or patients who are harmed by error, as, again, adversaries, like you say, rather than sort of thinking of the whole process as, you know, sort of part of being human, part of delivering healthcare, and there was that, you know, recognizing their responsibilities for making sure that they follow through on those, you know, human responsibilities, I guess. I don't mean to sound, you know, sort of unnecessarily, I guess, sort of the expression airy fairy comes to mind, but I mean it's not a fluid kind of thing. Although people sometimes talk about those human relations aspects of healthcare as very soft, I guess, but they're really, really important on many fronts. And when we neglect them, the damage can be really severe.
Let's take a little break here, and we'll be right back to talk some more with Dr. Clark about making sure that the patient is heard and feels acknowledged, and that their pain is understood to be real.
This is Keith Richards, aka Just Saying. Is there cancer in your family? There is in mine. But it doesn't have to be bad. We can take action to protect ourselves. I've learned how to get screened and manage my health so that I'll live a long, healthy life. How about you? Visit www.powerfulpatient.org. Again, that's www.powerfulpatient.org. Peace.
Welcome back. This is Joyce Graff, and we're talking with Dr. Sean Clark of the University of Toronto. We're talking about the best way to handle the communications after there has been a medical mistake.
As you say, the patient just wants to be heard, and they want their pain to be acknowledged. It's one of those things you learn with children. You know, if you have a three-year-old who falls down and comes and presents you with this badly damaged finger that you can scarcely see a little pink on, you know, and if you say, oh, no, it's nothing, you'll be fine, then they begin to scream.
Right.
Right. But if you kiss it and make a fuss over it, all of a sudden it's better.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's just a matter of acknowledging their pain, and it's very basic in us humans, and adults are a little bit more closed about it than a three-year-old, but nonetheless, that's very much there.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's very much making the time and also setting up a plan. I mean, when patients and healthcare professionals interact with each other, you never want to leave an appointment or an encounter without a sense of what comes next, I guess. And it's even more crucial when something goes off the rails that the patient have a clear sense of who's going to be looking after them and who's going to be following through on things.
Somewhere that University of Michigan was trying an experiment, and I'm sure by now other people are too, that when a mistake was made, that they should have a conference with the patient and family and explain that something did go wrong and apologize and talk, as you say, about, okay, so what goes next? And that as a result of that, that the number of lawsuits went down to 10% of what it had been before.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think you're right. I think a lot of other jurisdictions have sort of picked up on that. There are entire states that have sort of incorporated that into their guidelines for how hospitals should be operating. I think we've definitely moved into an era where disclosure, you know, sort of honest disclosure, is the preferred approach to all of this. At the same time, you know, honest disclosure doesn't mean cold-hearted. It means honesty. It also requires a great deal of sensitivity and thoughtfulness about the way the information is laid out. And again, you know, what we keep coming back to, this importance of making the patient feel listened to and making sure the patient knows that who is going to be following through and caring for whatever the results of the errors might have been.
Right. So if there was a sponge left in and a terrible infection ensued, obviously there's going to have to be some corrective action taken, and it should not be at the patient's expense. There should be some willingness on the part of the doctor or the institution to take responsibility for this additional cost.
Which I understand these days most institutions are most willing to pick up.
Right. I heard that the Medicare system is declining to pay for those kinds of additional charges.
Right, absolutely. So sort of in the new era of healthcare, sort of getting into what you might call the No Child Left Behind, the accountability movement, one of the new angles on this that the Medicare program has picked up on is that certain mistakes, the added charges or added costs of caring for patients that run into complications that could be prevented are no longer going to be picked up by the plan. So that's a great rationale for avoiding the problem in the first place, if it's at all possible, but it should absolutely be the institution and not the patient that picks up these costs. I think that's in most
right.
other countries besides the U.S., it is a normal matter of course that patients with legitimate claims of expenses or of injuries or of, you know, the need for ongoing care related to medical injuries, that this is a straightforward process that doesn't involve an adversarial sort of trial kind of setup or negotiation back and forth. Yeah.
It's understood that that should be the case.
Right.
So how do we prevent these medical errors in the first place? You're on the front lines with nurses and physicians trying to make sure that medical errors don't occur. How is it that we can go about doing that?
I think we need to make sure, I think the first thing is to educate health professionals and make sure that we build thinking about safety and everything that we know about preventing errors, that we really make it part of basic training programs and, you know, residencies and so forth, and orientation of new nurses as well as ongoing professional education. We know a lot of things about what kinds of errors happen most commonly, which are most severe, which cause the most severe injuries, and so forth. There's an awful lot of information out there to be had, and what you see when you talk to people in the field is until they decide that they're interested in patient safety, they don't necessarily go after it. There's a fantastic website developed by the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, AHRQ, and it's www.ahrq.gov, and it has wonderful patient safety resources. And I think sort of learning what we know up to this point about the kinds of errors that are out there is one really important step in educating professionals. I think the second big step is making sure that all clinicians and all managers understand how important good systems and teamwork are for preventing errors, and that patients and families are part of those teams. And then I would argue the third big thing that we need to do is, to the extent that's possible, without burdening patients and families, help them, the patients and families, understand their part, the part that they may play in keeping, you know, making their healthcare safer, I guess.
Right, that taking your medications faithfully and on time, calling when you have a question, things like that are very, very important.
Absolutely, and you know, asking when you have a suspicion that something's not quite right, asking the questions rather than making assumptions.
Right.
And there is research that's been done that shows that, for instance, with taking medications that are prescribed on an outpatient basis in clinics, doctors' offices, and so forth, even extremely well-educated people who don't necessarily have healthcare backgrounds can make very big errors in interpreting the instructions on the side of their medication bottle that may be very clear to a pharmacist, to a nurse, or to a physician, but they're not so clear to patients. It's amazing that the thousands upon thousands of emergency room visits every year are related to patients taking their medications that they've been prescribed in the community inappropriately. So getting those instructions safe is a really essential thing. And, you know, especially when treatments change, when physicians increase the doses or decrease the doses, or nurse practitioners, physician's assistants, as the case may be, or introduce a new medication, it's very important to pay attention, if at all, you know, to the greatest extent possible, and to ask those questions.
Right. Call your pharmacist, call your doctor, but don't just sit on that question. If you really think that something's wrong, you need to ask.
Absolutely.
Because someone might have made a mistake with all the best intentions. We're all human. One patient told me a story the other day. She was in the hospital overnight for observation. She had minor heart arrhythmia or something. And, of course, they don't let you take your own medications into the hospital. So the nurse came by to give her a pill. And she says, "What pill is this?" And the nurse says, "Whatever the doctor prescribed." So she said, "Well, this is a different color. This doesn't look like my medication." So the nurse got huffy with her and said, "Well, all right, I'll check on it. But meanwhile, I'll give you your shot." "Shot?" she says. "What shot?" She said, "Oh, your insulin." She's not diabetic.
Yes.
Yes. Now, this is potentially a very, very terrible problem, and she could potentially have killed her.
Absolutely.
So for the nurse to get huffy, I mean, this is what you're talking about. The patient has a right to ask, and the nurse should take it seriously and not just get huffy because somebody did make a mistake. Either that nurse or the pharmacist or somebody in that chain did make a mistake, and the patient's flagging it, and that's a legitimate request.
Absolutely. It's a very hard thing, though, because in terms of the psychology of being a health professional, that we're only starting to realize and educate people about, that defensiveness is a really dangerous thing.
Yeah, and the same thing for a doctor to act that way when a nurse calls them on it. I know I was reading an article not too long ago that was talking about emergency room care and the need for checklists in emergency rooms, and they tracked the number of infections that ensued from certain kinds of procedures and decided that if you were going to suture anything on the leg, the entire leg should be draped. And so they made up this checklist, but alongside the checklist, they empowered all the nurses to stop the procedure if some part of the checklist had been missed. And they just made it clear to everybody that every member of the team had equal power to call a halt to the procedure if something was not done. And I thought, you know, how smart that is, finally, to say the nurses are also smart. Sometimes the nurses do know better about little things like draping than the doctors. The doctors are concerned with deeper and more complex things, and draping may seem like a step that can be missed. But if it's going to significantly reduce the number of infections, it shouldn't be missed.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think one of the things that comes up that makes it all the more essential to make sure you have checklists and that people speak up when they see issues that others may have left out is just the pace that you see in all settings, emergency departments, hospital wards, intensive care units, clinics. I mean, people are moving so fast, seeing so many different patients, and I think that one of the things we're going to have to do is give some real thought to what the human limits are in terms of just how many patients you can process at much, how much you can do before the error rates become unacceptably high. In the meantime, giving people tools to help them catch these things, very, very important. And like you say, making sure that all of the information possible, the information that's out there, is used rather than, you know, sort of people staying silent because they're worried about annoying others or being punished for their observations that, you know, really might be in the patient's very best interests.
Right. I was speaking the other day with a physician from New Zealand, and one of the things he mentioned, we were talking about doing some elective surgeries in New Zealand instead of the U.S., because they can do them so much less expensively, and one of the things he pointed out was that the reason that his surgical specialty hospital is able to do things for less money is because they don't have to worry about the emergency care. The emergency care is done in the public system, and he's at a private hospital, and so they don't even have an emergency room.
Interesting.
isn't it?
So interesting.
Sort of dividing the responsibilities. And sometimes the doctors work in both settings, but it does make the surgery-only hospital a much less frenetic environment.
A tantalizing thought, and we'll come back to this in just a moment. Let's take a little break here, and we'll come back, and I'm going to tell you this week's winner of our contest for Food Matters, and we'll also have some announcements for you about some changes in the formatting of this show. We're going to be going forward in a slightly different way in the new year, and we hope that you'll continue to be with us and that we'll have maybe even more interesting programming for you. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
Hi, and welcome back. We're going to be talking with Dr. Sean Clark again in just a moment. And this week's winner of a free viewing of Food Matters is Phil Hyman of California. And Phil, we have for you a free viewing of the 80-minute feature film called Food Matters. You can see the promotional material at foodmatters.tv, and you can buy the DVD there. It's an excellent film about the importance of the right kinds of food and the difficulties of all the additives that are put into processed foods these days. It's very enlightening and one of the best presentations I have seen yet about the use of food to prevent or to manage various kinds of diseases. So please check that out. We'll be giving away a free viewing of this film for the next several weeks, courtesy of the makers of Film Matters. To enter our contest, simply send a question to questions@powerfulpatient.org, and we will be glad to enter you in the contest, and one of the questions submitted will be the winner each week. questions@powerfulpatient.org. So let's go back and talk some more with Dr. Clark about the tantalizing issue that we raised just before the break. Is the American model of the full-service hospital the better one, or is it better to have a hospital that's focused on surgical procedures and doesn't have the frenetic aspect of urgent care?
Yeah, certainly there's a big controversy in American healthcare about specialty hospitals that don't necessarily provide the gamut of services. For instance, they only do cardiac surgeries or certain kinds of orthopedic surgeries or cosmetic surgeries. It's very interesting. And very few people talk about the potential safety issues in not having, you know, sort of the full complement of doctors and nurses and treatment setting, you know, sort of special treatment areas like intensive care units to cover the possibilities that the patients might run into trouble. I don't think anybody talks about the possibility that having such surgeries done in these special places, that this might have some advantages for patient safety too, in that, as you say, people can be more specialized, concentrate at a less frenetic pace on what's really important that's going on.
And they're less likely to get paged to run over to the emergency room because there's been a big head-on crash.
Right.
It's Tuesday, he's not on call there.
Right, right. We have in Canada and the U.S., I think, there is a certain image that we have that excellent medical care is provided in these big, big complex medical centers with perhaps 1,000 or more beds and many, many, many different divisions. And, you know, we never can stand back and consider whether this is maybe, you know, not the best way to provide care, either from the patient's and family's point of view, because it can overwhelm them to be in this kind of an environment, or as you say, from a patient safety point of view, where people are just too thinly spread and where resources are going just too many different directions.
I was out at UCLA recently, and even the doctors were complaining about the complexity of the environment and how difficult it is to get from point A to point B in the complex and all the politics amongst the various institutions. So sometimes that the large institutions get a little too complex for their own good. But on the other hand, I often refer people. I say, go to the largest teaching hospital in your neighborhood. Why? Because they tend to attract the more highly skilled physicians. They can pay more for physicians, and so they'll tend to have higher levels of skill. And the other one is that they tend to have the equipment.
Right.
And much of the high-level surgeries require robotic equipment or some other microsurgical device. So tell me what you think about that.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean that there's definitely a trade-off between, you know, sort of small versus large. I think sometimes when you're talking about care for conditions that aren't necessarily all that common, and that you do need very sophisticated clinicians, you're not necessarily going to find them. You may find them in small community hospitals or in clinics, but often in order for them to see the volume of cases that, you know, to get to be experts or in order to provide really good care,
right,
you got to have the volume and you got to have the size. But at the same time, I think you're right that, you know, perhaps some of these centers are getting a little big for bigger than is good for themselves, because of all the complexity in terms of managing the places that brings about. But definitely for patients who and the clinicians. I mean, the clinicians, the doctors and nurses start to feel as if they are just numbers or cogs in a wheel or whatever, mm-hmm. And certainly the patients do too. I mean, I think we go back to that, what we were talking about before, this human factor. It can be a good feeling to feel sort of surrounded by high technology, the best science, the best clinicians, but at the same time you can feel dwarfed and insignificant when you're sort of in a situation like that. Mm-hmm. And that constant drive for expansion, that bigger is always better, is definitely a feature of healthcare, perhaps in some sectors, you know, more than others, perhaps in some countries more than others, but definitely, you know, there is this drive always to expand in terms of the physical plant, expand in terms of the numbers and the quantity of patients and the money that's being brought in, and that has some very real consequences that we rarely talk about. If you look at the U.S. News and World Report's rankings of hospitals, though, I mean, that's what we value, right? Some of those rankings are based on very real statistics about how well patients with different conditions do. But some of those statistics or some of those rankings are also based on reputation. And we assume all the time that the best places to be cared for are bigger hospitals when really that may not be the case. When one is relatively well and does not necessarily need very, very, you know, subspecialty attention or attention from clinicians who are really experienced in a particular subsegment of a clinical population. I guess when you're not looking at that, the best of all possible worlds is to have a community provider, an internist, or a pediatrician who is used to, handling complex cases when they come up, and knows when to refer, because sort of maintaining things from month to month, from year to year, requires a different kind of skill, I guess. Different resources, I guess. And I think it's probably often best done in smaller versus larger settings.
You know, a couple of years ago, I went on a tour one day of three different hospitals who have clinical care centers for von Hippel-Lindau disease here in Boston area. And I was really struck by the fact that one of them, the Leahy Clinic, has really built teamwork into their infrastructure in a very integral way. And it just came through in everybody that we talked with. They all were functioning as part of a team. They met once a week to talk about complex cases, especially the ones, you know, the cross medical specialties, which is sort of what a lot of my listeners are doing. You know, with a complex medical condition, you sometimes need a neurosurgeon and a urologist and somebody else. And when you have a condition like that, you need those guys to be talking to each other and comparing notes and saying, well, you know, if that symptom is there, which of our departments is it more likely to be in? Because sometimes what seems like a stomach upset could really be seated in the pancreas or in the brain or in a lot of other places, and you're not going to chase it down by talking to one specialist.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, sounds like some of these clinics that you're talking about are good examples of what they call, what some folks at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center, they have come to call the microsystems approach, that when you have a group of clinicians or a clinic that is looking after folks with either, you know, sort of medically complex conditions or even caring for patients who are dealing with more run-of-the-mill problems, that a healthcare system is only as good as the smallest unit and how good the coordination of information is in that smallest unit. And I think a lot of this communication actually has to be purposefully built in instead of left to chance. And I think we're seeing more and more indication that this is that this is a good thing, that not only health professionals but patients are expecting this rather than just being pleased to see it when it happens by chance.
Right, and teamwork is a state of mind, and you have to build it in from the top down.
Absolutely, and the members of the team have to be comfortable about what it is that they're bringing to the team, I suppose, so that you can actually get on with the business of figuring out what's going to be in the patient's best interests. I think what happens in healthcare sometimes is that the different members of the team, specialist physicians, medical practitioners versus surgeons and so forth, they, in the worst cases, they see themselves as in competition for the patient, and that doesn't necessarily need to be the case, but it has to be explicit, like you say.
I remember one time when my son was going to be having surgery, and I said, well, I think I need a second opinion, and the doctor said to me, oh, well, if you need a second opinion, I can get one of my colleagues to do that. And I went, no, I don't think so, because his colleague is unlikely to disagree with him. And I wanted to go to someone entirely unaffiliated with him to get a more objective opinion.
Right. I mean, it depends. It in some circumstances, I mean, it's always about what the patient and or the family feel most comfortable with, and especially when the decisions are really crucial ones. There's a decision to be made about whether to go forward with a treatment that could, you know, change the whole course of the patient's disease, perhaps not in a good way. You want to be very, very careful about this. But I think you absolutely want diversity of opinion when you go and you get second opinion. It is possible sometimes that even within the same medical center, you know, you have people who are interacting on a truly collegial level and that are willing to disagree. But I think you're right. I think sometimes if you're not absolutely confident of this, rather than sort of taking it on faith that the relationship of clinicians to each other isn't going to influence what that second opinion is going to be, that, you know, you go and you seek information, seek a read on the situation from somebody who's really independent, who doesn't have any stake in what the ultimate decision is.
One of the things that I tell people who are managing a complex condition is that they need to assemble a team of doctors. If they need a neurosurgeon and a urologist and a neuro-otologist or whatever else it takes to manage this condition, they need to see themselves as the kind of the owner of the team.
Mm-hmm.
And they get to hire and fire, and they get to help facilitate the communications, because that's what team leaders have to do. because the communications are not necessarily going to happen automatically, especially if these people are in different institutions. So what do you think of that approach?
I wish that that wasn't what was necessary in the vast majority of cases. I think that if a family member or the patient themselves, if they're in a position to, doesn't sort of play that role of coordinating, often it doesn't happen. I think, though, increasingly people are seeing, you know, sort of with, as I say, this microsystems approach and so forth, and sort of attention to this necessity to be what they call interdisciplinary, I guess, mm-hmm. in the way you look at patient problems. I think it's more common that somebody on the healthcare team would actually play the role of quarterback or team leader. I think in a lot of cases it's going to fall to a family member or again the patient themselves to do that coordination. I think that it can be a really stressful thing to be doing that work and to be dealing with the different personalities that are involved and the different issues. And I think what happens is the patients and families become remarkably, incredibly well informed about all kinds of different areas of medical management. And they become fairly comfortable talking about fairly complex issues. I think that not everybody is necessarily in a position to take this on, though, and right. that as a healthcare system, we need to have some supports for people who are trying to take this role of team leader on when they're lay people. But I think there also need to be some backups for folks that can't necessarily contend with this. I think that's where it can be a really good thing if, on top of all these different specialists who might be involved in care, that you do have somebody who's back in your community who is a generalist who is fairly sophisticated and feels comfortable sort of being a way station, I guess, for information and so forth, and who has a good trusting relationship with the patient and family.
Yeah, that would be great. And it would be wonderful if there were someone, as you say, to help quarterback that. And unfortunately, it's usually not there. But in the institutions where it is, that's a blessing, and they should certainly be commended for that.
We'll be back in just a moment to talk some more with Dr. Clark about moderating the cost of healthcare as well by the judicious use of communications. So please stay with us through the break, and we'll be right back to finish our conversation with Dr. Clark and tell you more about what's ahead. Please go to powerfulpatient.org, where you will find the handout that goes with this show, with more information about the websites that we've mentioned, the concepts that we've talked about, and some additional information about Dr. Clark and his program as well. So please do go to powerfulpatient.org, and while you're there to look for the handout, we hope you'll make a contribution and help us help bring back this program another day. Thank you. Thanks for staying with us. Before we go back to talk more with Dr. Clark, I just wanted to give you a few hints about what's ahead in the new year. We are going to be moving to a new format. Instead of doing the one-hour shows, we're going to be doing shorter programs and more as podcasts than radio broadcasts. So we hope that you'll continue to pick up our shows and to continue to enjoy them. You can still click on them and listen to them over the internet, or you can download them to your iPod if you want. So they'll still be available as MP3 files on the internet, and they will also still be available as podcasts, but through some additional broadcasting channels. And we look forward to working with you in the new year. Let's go back now and speak some more with Dr. Clark about quality of healthcare. We're talking about organizing your healthcare team, and often the patient is the quarterback or the team manager, one of those, whichever image you like better. But not everybody is prepared to do that as a patient. Sometimes you need someone else to help you, and what Dr. Clark is proposing is that in the healthcare system somewhere, there is some assistance for people who may need a little bit of help with fostering these communications and managing the team.
I think that, I mean, in terms of healthcare costs too, I mean, you know, it's we're concerned on many, many levels about the cost of healthcare, and people with complex medical conditions, generally speaking, you know, sort of are work very hard and actually manage their health conditions beautifully in a lot of cases and keep their costs to a minimum. I think that, I mean, some of the people who need to be brought into the discussion about putting the right resources in place are the insurance, you know, the insurers and the payers, the people in Medicare and so forth. These issues and the need for this coordination needs to be brought to light, because better decisions will be made and less waste will happen, and you'll have not only happier clinicians, but most importantly, a happier patient and family.
Right, and a judicious use of nurse practitioners and genetic counselors, and not just as I know there's sometimes this difficulty in getting reimbursement for genetic counseling services, because it can take an hour and a half to talk with somebody about, you know, the risks in your family. And there doesn't seem to be a recognition on the part of the payer that, yes, it takes a long time, but that's because it takes a long time. People have a difficult time absorbing this information because it's highly emotional. And if you don't take that time, they're not going to get it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you mentioned nurse practitioners, and I have a fairly soft spot for nurse practitioners. I was trained as one. I didn't practice as one, and I work here in Toronto now with a lot of nurse practitioners. I think that, you know, in particularly complex cases where there are a lot of different conditions that are being managed, an awful lot of different considerations that bring in different specialists, that nurse practitioners absolutely can play a role. Often you see nurse practitioners who have a lot of great experience under their belts in terms of helping patients and families deal with this coordination, this element of coordinating different specialists. And nurses, by their training, they're not the only group of health professionals that has this background, but they have a special orientation, I suppose, towards the helping patients and families cope over the long term. Mm-hmm. And especially in clinics and so forth, and specialized clinics, they can be a wonderful resource, and actually, in a lot of cases, may be very well prepared and have a great role and a great perch from which to help do some of this coordination that you were talking about earlier.
Just in cardiac care, I remember, I think 15 years ago, there was a study done by, I believe it was Dr. Thomas Del Bianco at Beth Israel in Boston, who did a study on how well people did when they were communicated with in a different way. There was the patient who was just given the basic information about the cardiac procedure he was going to undergo, and then they had another group of patients with similar characteristics where they brought the family in and they had a family meeting that explained what was going to go on and how he was going to feel and what care he was going to need at home, and did all the sort of touchy-feely kind of orientation with the patients. And that second group of patients recovered remarkably faster.
I think there are an awful lot of ideas out there in health psychology that have really sort of become sort of in part of the landscape, I guess, in healthcare. Things that promote healing, and those, like you say, are absolutely things like giving patients information when it's the right kind of information, helping them draw on their networks of support when they're out there, and giving them a sense of control when it's possible to do that. Mm-hmm. I think one of the most important things we've learned, though, is that different patients and different family members respond in different ways to information that they're given. And things that promote coping in one group of people may not help others quite as much, and sometimes may upset them, I guess. And so, I mean, while it's really important to look at approaches that will, you know, that recognize and are sensitive to all of the emotional issues the patients go through, and that take into consideration that patients are members of families who can be wonderful supports to them, I think we can never forget that there's a lot of differences between people. And it's important to explore and to ask and to figure out what sort of supports are really going to be most useful to the specific patient, rather than assuming across the board that one particular size is going to fit all. I was at a conference last week where a group of nurses were comparing the experience for patients of getting to choose what questions the admitting nurse answered about their particular procedure, and another approach where it was a standard list of questions and answers that the nurse ran through before the procedure. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting because a lot of the patients who were asked to pick out the questions they wanted answered became very, very anxious in the end, and they were not any more satisfied than the group of patients that got sort of the preset list of questions. Mm-hmm. One of the answers, you know, one of the potential reasons for this was probably that when you're very anxious and you're awaiting a procedure, you want some guidance about what it is that you're actually going to go through, like the study at Beth Israel you were talking about, and you want some structure around things. So when we're trying, we need to be very sensitive to the idea, you know, that they're, you know, you need to give patients a sense of control, and you need to give them information, but what you need to give them the information that they can handle, and in a form that's going to be useful to them, and not assume that giving them blanket choices about things is necessarily the right way to go. Sometimes they really want, patients really want to be guided.
I remember when my son was 15 and going in for his first kidney surgery. The anesthesiologist came in the day before the surgery, and he's going through this list of these are all the various things that could happen to you, convulsions, and you could die, and you could be a vegetable, and blah, blah, blah. And my son was turning white as he was going through this list. And so I turned to the anesthesiologist, and I said, if you were Jimmy the Greek, what kind of odds would you give him that any of those things on that list are going to happen? Oh, under 2%, he says. And then my son started breathing again. But, you know, I think, it, as you say, the context is so important, because an 84-year-old man with emphysema, those risks are in the 40-50% range.
Right.
But for a 15-year-old kid who's facing his very first surgery and is pretty healthy, they're almost unheard of. So somehow we have to put it all into perspective for people and help people understand what their real risks are.
And that takes time, and that's the human component all over again, you know, sort of really putting things, trying to see things through the eyes of patients and giving them the context that they need and giving them, you know, sort of like the three bears, you know, not too much, not too little, just the right information.
Right.
Yeah.
Differs for everyone, and that's one of the reasons that nurses are so important to us, because they are willing and able to take the time and really listen for those human elements.
And I think we see when there are surveys that are done of the public in terms of their perceptions of different health, different occupations and different professions in our society, nurses are a fairly trusted group. You know, they sort of rank up at the top, because I think in a lot of ways patients think of nurses correctly, I believe, as the face of healthcare and as their voice sometimes and their conduit, their angle in on important information and getting their concerns dealt with.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Sean. I really appreciate your joining us today, and congratulations on your new position, and I wish you great success.
Thank you so much for your time.
Great to get some good ideas from Dr. Clark, and I hope that you will continue to work on your own condition, making sure that you or the person who advocates for you is a good team leader, is getting the information that you need, is not shy to ask for clarification or for second opinions, for help understanding the medications or the instructions. All of this is critically important. Make sure that you understand it so that you can be a valued member of your own healthcare team. And if you see anything going on in the hospital that you don't like, you are welcome, you are encouraged to ask that question. As a matter of fact, recently I was in the emergency room at one of the hospitals here in Boston, and there's a sign up there that says, you as a patient have every right to say to that medical professional, the nurse or whoever, did you wash your hands? So it is up to us to help remind them. It's not our responsibility, but it's our right. And so we need to watch out for our own selves and try to make sure that things always go well for us. Those of us who do a lot of hospital time, as one of my friends says, we need to be particularly vigilant because the odds are greater that at some point some medical mistake will in fact occur. And if we can help to ward it off, then we can make sure that there aren't going to be any nasty consequences from that. So thank you very much for being with us this week. We hope that you'll be with us next week as well. We're going to talk about some of the powers of faith and relaxation techniques in helping you heal, enhancing your immune system, and moving forward, because it's very important to manage our emotions as well. Our emotions govern our bodies just as our bodies govern our emotions. It's all connected, and the interplay there is very, very powerful. So come learn with us next week, and meanwhile, we hope that you will be well and be a powerful patient. Thank you.